is happening out there, y'all. And thank y'all again so much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, the creature of habit, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios in a beautiful October day.
Tell them what we're watching. What's on in the background?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes.
One of the finest movies ever made. It is. It's a classic, right? And it holds up.
Oh, man. Every time it's on.
Every time it's on. No matter what channel it's on, I got to tune in.
Indiana Jones fan, man. Indiana Jones. Be a sad day when we lose Mr. Jones.
I got to tune in because I love the lore. Yes. You know, it's the romanticism of it. The time period, everything about it. Archaeology, as everybody knows, big fan of archaeology. Yeah. Big fan of mysteries. Paranormal stuff is going on, you know. It's just, I love that kind of stuff.
I know.
It's inspired us to do this show all these years later. You know what?
What?
Been sitting in my deer stand quite a bit. And I haven't really seen much than a cottontail rabbit that shows up every time on time.
Have you named him yet where y'all can have a conversation?
Peter. Peter Cottontail.
No,
yeah.
Nice.
I talk to him every time he comes out. I'm like, yep, go get you some. Now, I have been seeing lots of activity. It just never happens when I'm there. Yeah. So, obviously, I'm not doing something right. The star, I think the moon's messed it up.
Yeah.
Stars haven't aligned. But it is getting cooler. I'm enjoying it. And you know what? I enjoy sitting there in the quiet.
I do, too. That's why I had to make it a little quieter where I was at just the other day.
Ha ha! I know what you mean.
A dozen. I had 12 pigs come in. Remember, I was texting. She asked me if I'd seen anything. I said, bro, I ain't seen nothing. It's been dead. I hadn't seen or heard a thing. It was in the passing. I'd seen some deer a few hundred yards off, but that was it. I'm hunting this little travel point where I'd seen a lot of deer, and I'd cast a little corn out there going, it'll slow them down if they come through. Well, the pigs found it. So when the pigs found it, I just made it a point from now on. I'm pig hunting them to try to put the herd on them. And I had a dozen of them come in right after Kyle had text. And I said, oh, I hear squealing. I had 12 pigs come in, 10 pigs left out of there.
Nice.
That's all with the recurve. I'm like, it was quiet. They come in. I'm just putting them down. So, yeah, that was good times.
Some pulled pork sandwiches.
I'm
going
to go put
good,
you
right?
in there, too. You're going to have to go sit in the ladder next because if they keep coming in, you can fall out of the ladder stand and hit them. That's what makes it so nice.
That is
yeah,
awesome.
So that's what we've been up to. We've been in the woods a lot.
We went to the state fair, me and my wife, and it was a good time. Look, we used to take the kids when they were little, but that's, you know, any typical fair like that with the midway and stuff, it's hard because you have three kids that are going in different directions. This one wants to ride that ride. This one doesn't want to ride that one. He wants to ride this one. He mm-hmm. wants to play this game. And it's chaotic, right? And it's crowded. It can be, I know it's fun for the kids, but it can be a hassle for the grownups, right?
Overwhelming, yeah, at times.
And I mean, I remember everything is based on coupons, you know, they don't take money. And you'd get these cards, and they would burn through $400, Cam, in like 20 minutes. I mean, no, easy. But the last like 3 years we've been going, and it's just been me and my wife. And it's a fun time. We get a chance to try some new foods. We get to look at all the new cars, all the vendors there that are selling different things. I got two new belts. Because there's this awesome vendor there that actually has real leather belts and for really cheap. And so I get custom-made belts when I go there. I know it's crazy, but...
Let me ask you this. Did you get them one size bigger or one size larger this year?
One size smaller.
I mean, smaller, rather.
Yeah, smaller.
Smaller.
Yeah.
Good for you,
yeah,
brother.
Yeah.
Good
yeah,
for you.
I've been drinking the AG1 and walking. We went and hiked Johnson's Peak, too. So I've been getting lots of exercise.
Now, don't forget the state fairs where I met Grady Styles back in the day.
Really?
That was the Lobster Boy.
Oh, man.
We have a whole show of me talking about that. If y'all want to hear something wild about actually sitting and talking to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was before his family killed him.
Yeah. Oh, they did. Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good time, though. If
he wasn't such a good guy, but he was whenever I was in junior high, like the first time I ever met him, sat there and talked to him.
But yeah, we had a good time. What have you been doing?
I've been in the woods.
That's it. Nothing special. Just hunting.
Nothing. I've just been working around the house, doing some stuff and been in the woods, just doing things along those lines.
But hopefully if you're in the woods, you didn't have an frightening encounter like this person did. Check this out. It says, hello. I had an extremely frightening experience 5 years ago that I had no idea what was going on. But when I happened to run across a description of the Men in Black, which I've never heard about, except for, you know, passing references to the Will Smith movie, I suddenly realized this is extremely similar to what I experienced. My mouth dropped open at the similarity. What happened was I used to be a postal delivery person in Washington, D.C. One of the buildings I delivered mail to on my route was this huge building. One day, I'd paused to eat an apple outside the building, and not seeing a trash can anywhere, I just threw the core onto the ground. When I walked into the building to deliver the mail, I was angrily confronted by the head of security. The guy asked me why I was littering. I was a little taken back and asked him how he knew that I had thrown the apple core on the ground. He told me that this whole premises is under surveillance video, including only not just front and back, but all sides, even the grassy areas around it. It was then I suddenly realized this building had really unusually tight security. Even when I went inside to deposit the mail room was open to me, but the rest of the building was inaccessible. I could only go into the mail room, deposit the mail, and then leave. I had to ring a buzzer to be let into the building each time I delivered. Anyway, a few weeks later, I was on my way to deliver the mail as usual to the same building. And as I was nearing the building, I saw three figures crossing the street on their way towards the building. At first glance, I thought they were normal. But as I looked closer, I was shocked at how strange they were. They were extremely thin. They didn't walk by putting one leg in front of the other, but sort of waddled by moving their whole bodies from side to side, lifting one foot off the ground and then the other foot in sort of a whole body side to side waddle. It looked like they had just learned how to walk. It was hard to explain what I mean, but it was not only the way that any normal person would walk unless they were unable to move some of their joints in their legs. But as strange as this was not what was frightening to me. What frightened me was that they were absolutely thin. It was like they were as flat as a set of clothes that had been ironed. Their faces and bodies were entirely flat. There was almost no contours. The nose did not jut out. Nothing. They were also extremely thin. The best thing I could describe is if you saw a suit hanging from a clothes hanger. That would be about the same thickness. It was like there was no thickness at all, just clothes hanging from a hanger. All three were dressed in black suits. They all had black sunglasses on. I saw them walk up, ring the buzzer to be let into the building. I was absolutely scared, as I had just been about to enter that same building. I really wasn't sure what to do, but I kind of steeled myself and slowly forced myself to ring the buzzer and enter the building, figuring, hey, I might have just imagined this. In any case, I should force myself to go through my routine until I can think this thing out. When I entered the mailroom, there were like 10 normal men standing there, just looking at me. It was really intimidating. They asked me, have you seen anything strange? I was kind of speechless for a second, not knowing how to respond. And then one of them walked right up to me from the side and from slightly behind me. I could tell it was one of the same type things that I had just seen crossing the street. It walked right up to me. And I was too afraid to turn my head to the side to look at it. I'm very scared just typing this up right now, remembering it. It didn't say anything. It just got right up close to me. I had the feeling of fear. It was so intense. I felt as if my heart had just frozen, was going to fall out of my body and onto the ground. Again, they asked me, did you see anything? What did you see? I shook my head and shambled, no, I didn't see anything. Unless they were all mentally slow, there was no way they couldn't have noticed my extreme fright. I thought they might hold me there and not let me go, but finally they said, okay, leave now. The men in black that was to my side and left behind me kind of took a step back and made way for me to leave. I had to steel myself to actually walk past it on my way to the door, and I was out of the building. It's the bravest thing I've ever done in my whole life. Now, at the time, I had never heard of the Men in Black other than the silly movie. I had no idea what this thing was or what the government was doing. All I knew was that I was dealing with something far more powerful than me. I thought maybe it was some type of new robot the government was doing tests on or whatever. But I don't know if they would do that in broad daylight. To give you an understanding of how frightening it was, the first thought that came to my mind when I was what I needed to leave the country. Find some way to get the heck out of this country and go somewhere else. But then it occurred to me that if I started to act strangely, it might get suspicious and kill me or something. I realized the best thing I could do was to act normally as possible and pretend nothing had happened. Later the next week, my supervisor at the post office told me I had been suddenly reassigned from my old route to a new one. That was very unexpected. He asked me if I had encountered any problems on my route. I think he even may have been a little confused as to why I was being reassigned, but I said no, I had no problems and was very quiet about it. So eventually I got reassigned. After what I thought was an appropriate amount of time continuing to work at the same post office, I quit my job and now I work at an airport. I'm telling you this story because 5 years later, I need to get this off my chest. I doubt they will come after me now. If they do, I can't avoid my fate. I've never seen any sort of alien or had any unusual life event of a UFO or some other strange sighting, nor do I believe that there is such thing as a devil or demons or anything, so I really don't know what to believe. I know that these were not human beings. They were not people, but something copying a person. It was very strange. I think it was some sort of cyborg experiment. And on occasion, I still am tempted to leave this country to get away from all this. Thanks for all you do, Lucy.
Wow.
All I could think of is, what is it, in Men in Black 2, when they go to pick up Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, yeah.
They go get Kay.
Right, right.
And it's Bismarcky, rest in power, Bismarcky.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, he's in there with Will doing all of it and all of it. Oh, that's the kind of mailroom that I picture you walk into. Like, you're not, they're all aliens but you.
Right. Well, and that's what I'm going to be talking about on this, today's show, is some more Men in Black sightings and stuff. And it is very strange because it's, first of all, the first thing that's strange is, how do they know you had a sighting, right? If you see people, how many of these people come forward after seeing a UFO or something, that they approach you, they knock on your door, they want to ask you some questions. And all the stories say that they don't act quite right. They don't, first of all, they're like, they have no eyebrows. They don't have eyelashes. They're very pale. They're always white. They're wearing sunglasses, black suits, a fedora. They don't seem to understand our customs. Like, they don't know what to, how to drink.
Crazy.
Right. You know, if they offer some coffee or something to drink, they just act odd. And so nobody really knows what these mysterious figures are. And so I like it when we get stories like this. But you have a story.
Oh, yeah. Well, and like, you're talking about the way they act, is it's so unsettling in just the little nuances that they miss. That's the thing, right? It's all, like, if you didn't know, you would think it was almost done on purpose to make it more so unsettling. This one, of course, folks, I got to drop this on y'all. My homie Lon knows how to take care of me because he knows what gets me fired up. I've got to read this to you, Mr. Filson. It's something you're going to really enjoy, since I commute for my job. It's a retail job, but I live in a rural area in the Southern California foothills, and it's currently my only option. I drive home every night near 1 a.m. I take the highway. Now, it's always deserted at these times, and some nights were more peculiar than others, but nothing so extreme as this incident. It's not uncommon for me to see a lot of wildlife on these drives. I would just take it slow and be alert normally, and occasionally I'd see a black-tailed deer, or coyotes, and raccoons, etc. Well, one recent night, I was only about 10 minutes away from home, and I rolled up to the usual four-way stop that I had stopped at hundreds of times before, not a soul around. As I came to a complete stop, I saw something, just standing off the side of the road across from the intersection. It was obviously an animal, and it was headed towards the road, so I was going to wait for it to cross. It took me a second to really comprehend what it was at first. I thought it was a horse, which, although dangerous, wouldn't be uncommon for where I live due to irresponsible ranchers and their constantly broken fences. Then, as I started to be able to make out more of what it was as it neared the lights from my headlights, I realized something was very, very wrong with this animal. It was tall, so much so that its legs looked stilt-like. As I sat there, shocked, it slowly stepped into the road and came across my car's direct beam from my headlight. At this point, I realized two things. One, it was much taller than my car. Its height was monstrous. And two, its gait was very odd, almost like it didn't know how to properly walk, as a deer should. It was like all of its joints wanted to bend the wrong way. It moved slowly into the oncoming lane and then swiveled its head back to look at me. All the hair on my body rose. What spooked me was the most was that it was certainly a deer, or at least something that looked like one. It looked normal in every way except the spider-like legs it was standing on. At this point, I gasped it, and then the deer stood unmoving as my car sped past. I looked back in my rearview mirror and caught a glimpse of it crossing the oncoming lane back into the shoulder of the highway, illuminated by my red brake lights. When I got home, I ran into my house and locked the doors. I'm still understandably freaked out. Thanks, D.
Wow.
So a taller than their vehicle, taller than their car.
Yeah, yeah.
Instantly, right? You're like, wait a minute. I like the idea. It's like, oh, it looks like a horse. That gives you a good example of its height. Except it's a deer. on spindly legs. And it just, they don't make those.
It seems like there's been an increasing number of sightings of the not deer.
They're picking up. Yeah. And that's kind of unsettling.
Yeah. But what could it be? Yeah. What could it be? Like, what were they mistaking it for? That's what I don't understand.
And whatever this creature is that's taking on the look of a deer, why deer? Obviously, you're having trouble nailing this one down. Why don't you try a skunk first? Why don't you go for something smaller? How about a dog? But why deer?
I don't know. I think it has to do with like Native American folklore and stuff. I think it's more like skinwalker. Yeah.
I'm with you.
Well, let's take a break, folks. When we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about some more Men in Black sightings. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
The enigmatic and mysterious Men in Black, often abbreviated as MIB, have long captured the imagination of conspiracy theorists, UFO enthusiasts, and pop culture aficionados alike. Emerging from the shadowy depths of urban legends, these elusive figures are commonly portrayed as United States federal government agents, shrouded in black suits and tasked with one peculiar mission: suppressing evidence related to UFO encounters. However, the intrigue surrounding the Men in Black extends far beyond their supposed government affiliation, delving into the realms of extraterrestrial conspiracy theories and a complex web of secrecy. In popular culture, the image of the Men in Black has become iconic, synonymous with enigmatic, otherworldly figures who appear mysteriously after UFO sightings. Yet, it is essential to note that not all Men in Black are necessarily government operatives, nor do they always wear the iconic dark suits. The term Men in Black has evolved to encompass a broader spectrum of mysterious individuals who intervene in the aftermath of encounters with unidentified flying objects. One of the most tantalizing theories surrounding these shadowy figures suggests that the Men in Black are not merely human agents, but rather, they might be aliens themselves in clever disguises. This notion blurs the lines between conspiracy and science fiction, creating and captivating a narrative that challenges conventional understanding of the UFO phenomenon. Some proponents of this theory argue that these extraterrestrial MIB are part of a clandestine effort to keep humanity in the dark about the existence of otherworldly beings and advanced civilizations. Within the intricate tapestry of UFO lore, the emergence of the Men in Black paints a multifaceted picture. While some contactees present a rosy and optimistic view of their encounters with UFOs and their occupants, others believe in the existence of sinister forces actively opposing the so-called Space Brothers and their benevolent missions. These antagonistic forces, both extraterrestrial and terrestrial, are thought to work together in a covert alliance, intent on obstructing the revelation of the truth regarding UFOs and their potential implications for humanity. On today's show, I'm going to be taking a further look into the world of the Men in Black. Let's begin. At around 3 p.m. on June 24, 1947, a pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold was searching for an aircraft that he had reportedly crashed into the southwest side of Mount Rainier, a better than 14,000-foot peak situated on Washington State's huge Cascade Mountain Range. His search that day was destined to discover something far different than an ordinary airplane. He said, "I hadn't flown more than 2 or 3 minutes on my course when a bright flash reflected on my airplane." He later said, "It startled me, as I thought it was too close or some other aircraft that I was too close to. I looked in every place in the sky and couldn't find where the reflection had come from until I looked to the left and the north of Mount Rainier, where I observed a chain of 9 peculiar-looking aircraft flying from north to south at approximately 9,500 feet in elevation and going seemingly in a definite direction of about 170 degrees. Arnold later added that the mysterious craft were closing in quickly on Mount Rainier, and he admitted to being mystified by their overall unconventional design. He said, "I thought it was very peculiar that I couldn't find their tails, but assumed that they were some type of jet plane. The more I observed these objects, the more upset I became, as I am accustomed to and familiar with most all objects flying, whether I'm close to the ground or at higher altitudes. The chain of these saucer-like objects were at least 5 miles long. I felt confident after I would land and there would be some explanation of what I saw." So began the first ever widely reported account of a UFO sighting in the United States. No one could offer Arnold the explanation he sought, and as the United States became a stronger magnet for strange aerial objects throughout the summer months of 1947, the military quickly swung into action, hoping to answer these vital questions. Who exactly was flying these saucers? Where were they from? And why were they here? It was not just the military that wanted definitive answers either. The frenzied summer of 1947 also succeeded in firing up the minds and imaginations of everyday folk across the United States and the world. Many of them ultimately embarked upon lifelong quests to find the truth behind the saucers themselves. Not all of them were happy with the data they unearthed either. In the case of a man named Albert Bender, that's putting things mildly. It was Bender, in fact, who almost single-handedly ushered in a plague of the Men in Black. Just as Arnold inaugurated the era of the UFO, for Bender, it all began with excitement and intrigue. But his story ultimately became dominated by horror, paranoia, and ill health, leaving behind a trio of cold-hearted, darkly dressed figures that have systematically, mentally tortured whole swaths of the population since. As a resident of Bridgeport, Connecticut, Albert Bender had a fascination with strange and unearthly phenomenon that actually predated the Kenneth Arnold affair of June 1947 by approximately a year and a half, and that ultimately spiraled downward into a full-blown, unhealthy obsession. The phenomenon that started Bender on his paranormal path occurred on December 5, 1945, when a squadron of Avenger-class aircraft vanished under circumstances that are still provoke controversy to this day. After taking to the skies from the Naval Air Station at Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the disappearance of this Flight 19, as well as a Mariner flying boat that was in search of the ill-fated planes and their 9 crew members, has today become nearly legendary and is now an integral part of the lore of the so-called Bermuda Triangle. We've covered a whole episode on Flight 19. A far more down-to-earth theory suggests that the pilots of Flight 19 simply got lost. They became catastrophically disoriented in the process, and they ran out of fuel, and they ditched somewhere in the Atlantic, which became their final resting place. Whatever the truth of the matter, the story immediately caught the attention of the 23-year-old Albert Bender. Using this case as a starting point, he began to dig deeply into the collective works of one of the most renowned chroniclers of all things weird and paranormal, Charles Fort, after whom the equally renowned magazine Fortean Times takes its name. By the time of Kenneth Arnold's sighting in the summer of 1947, Bender was living in one of several modified sections on the top floor of an old three-story house, with only a stepfather for company. As his fascination with flying saucers began to grow, Bender spent more and more time locked inside the upper room, an offshoot of the attic. In other words, where he carefully pursued paranormal books, journals, and newspaper clippings, and made good use of a newly acquired telescope, too, on nearly a nightly basis, excitedly scanning the heavens for anything saucer-shaped. UFOs weren't the only strange things that had gotten their hooks into Bender's mind, though. His life was steeped in the literary gothic horrors of Bram Stoker, Mary Shelley, and Edgar Allan Poe. He also had a tremendous fascination with the occult. Seances, black magic, Ouija boards, and witchcraft were all part and parcel of what it was to be Albert Bender in the late 1940s. Unsurprisingly, living a solitary existence in a dark attic, Bender's character and life began to subtly change, bit by bit, piece by piece, and not in a particularly positive fashion. One day out of the blue, Bender took it upon himself to paint the walls of the attic with the faces of grotesque, nightmarish creatures. It was a curious task that kept him toiling busy for no less than 8 months. Bender's chamber of horrors, as he increasingly began to refer to it, was starting to take its wretched, malevolent shape. For a while, at least, Bender even mused upon the idea of turning the entire upper floor into something resembling a haunted house that he planned to charge thrill seekers excitedly to explore. Nothing ultimately came of such a venture, however, and at a local level, Bender was beginning to develop a bit of a reputation as someone who was a tad off their kilter. By Bender's own admission, there were superstitious folk in town that had heard of his activities and viewed him as a full-blown menace. The strange life and times of Albert Bender were blighted by psychological issues as well. He displayed clear symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder. He had a specific set place for everything in his cherished attic, and he could immediately tell if anything was moved, even slightly, outside of its strict, rigid confines, and would become highly irritated. He was accused by friends of being overly fussy, as a result of his need to have total control over just about everything within his personal environment. Bender may have also been a fully paid-up hypochondriac. Although only a young man at the time of his UFO interests began, he developed and lived in absolute dread of getting some form of cancer. It should be noted that high strangeness had significantly afflicted the Bender family for years prior to Albert's own experiences. A cousin of his, as a child, undergone a nightmarish bedroom visitation from a woman in black, and a precursor to the nightmare in which Bender eventually found himself immersed. Another relative in northern Pennsylvania died of a brain hemorrhage that certain members of the family came to believe was due to the actions of a supernatural entity that haunted the shadowy corners of a nearby cemetery. In other words, for much of Bender's clan, ghosts, specters, horrific beasts, and creepy situations were central facets of everyday life. It was in December 1950 that flying saucers took center stage for Bender. He began to more seriously collect and cross-reference and many reports and stories that came his way. He hooked up with like-minded devotees of the space people, and he embarked upon the first tentative steps of an ambitious project, namely to establish a worldwide network of UFO investigators to be called the International Flying Saucer Bureau, or IFSB, which ultimately came to fruition in April of 1952 and led Bender to publish his very own magazine, called the Space Review. Incredibly, Bender, dwelling in the heart of a dark and shadowy occult-dominated attic in the home of his stepfather, achieved something that I strongly incline to suspect went far beyond his wildest dreams. If the IFSB did not only blossom and bloom, it also caught the attention of flying saucer disciples all across the planet. UFO reports poured into the IFSB, and people eagerly clamored to become members of this group. And Bender spent night after night faithfully answering letters of the cosmic sort that reached him by the sack load. Everything seemed to be going well. A solid network of saucer devotees had been created, and the IFSB appointed representatives in a number of different countries, including Britain and Australia. And in no time at all, Bender's little group became a fairly significant force on the UFO research scene. However, in one of those classic live-fast-die-young scenarios, the IFSB was not destined to last long. It was stark fear rather than the pompous, ego-driven bureaucracy that blights so many UFO research groups that brought the IFSB to a grinding halt. The beginning of the end began on the night of July 30th, 1952, only a few months after the IFSB was established, and when an anonymous telephone call was made to the Bender residence. With his stepfather not around, Albert was the one fate destined to answer it. When he picked up the phone, no one spoke, but Bender was instinctively certain that someone was at the other end of the line, listening intently in eerie silence. Bender's head began to spun and throbbed alarmingly, and he was forced to retire to his bed. A few days later, fully recovered, Bender went along to his local movie theater. A new sci-fi flick was due to be screened, and his love was eagerly awaiting its appearance. The movie proved to be uneventful, but the walk home, shortly before the arrival of the witching hour, was most definitely not uneventful. As he negotiated the dark sidewalks, an increasingly concerned Bender was sure that some hostile figure was pursuing him. He made it home without incident. However, and his stepfather was already sleeping, he made his quiet and careful way to the attic. On approaching the door, a fearful Bender could not fail to see that an eerie glow emanated from the thin gap directly beneath the doorframe. He flung open the door and was confronted by a strong smell of burning sulfur and a bright, shimmering object hovering in his room. Suddenly, Bender's eyes felt severely irritated, at which point he turned on the light, and the strange object vanished instantly. With his OCD now no doubt kicking in big time, Bender could see that certain IFSB files were not quite where they should be. Something or someone had been rifling through his precious flying saucer material. Bender tried valiantly to put his upsetting experience behind him and focused on other matters, such as the day-to-day activities of the IFSB, methodically affixing large plastic spiders to the ceiling of the attic with which to terrify visiting friends, an entirely normal action for a 30-something-year-old, of course. And he began hanging out at the local cinema. The latter would yet again prove to be a costly action. On a night in November 1952, Bender was happily watching the latest sci-fi release when he was overwhelmed by a strange and unsettling feeling. It was a mixture of dread and trepidation, and a sense of being intently stared at from the darkness of the old cinema. Suddenly, out of the corner of his eye, Bender was horrified to see a human-like form materialize in a nearby seat. It was a well-dressed man in dark clothes, had seemingly appeared out of nowhere. The shadowy figure could hardly be considered a local, however. For one thing especially, his eyes glowed like flashlight bulbs. Bender was once again afflicted by sudden dizziness. His head swirled, and he was forced to close his eyes as he sought to lessen the nausea that quickly threatened to engulf him. On opening them, a relieved Bender could see that the spectral being had vanished. He tried in vain to focus his attention on the movie, but again it was to no avail. Minutes later, he had yet another distinct and uneasy feeling of being watched by unknown forces. Bender, slowly and apprehensively, turned around. There, yet again, was the glowing-eyed, well-dressed fiend of the night, staring coldly and harshly at Bender, who wasted no time in awe and hightailing it back to the comfort of his attic. Throughout the next few months, Bender's dizzy spells continued. Brief manifestations of dark-suited entities plagued his days and nights. Alarming outbreaks of poltergeist activity occurred in the attic. Brimstone-like odors proliferated, sometimes for days, and he began to develop intense migraine-like headaches. It was at the height of his mental and physical torment, midway through 1953, that three men, dressed in dark clothes, treated Bender to the worst of all his varied visitations. According to the initial story, that quickly did the rounds in flying saucer research circles, the trio of mysterious characters revealed to a panic-stricken Bender the dark truth behind the UFO presence on our world, but warned him, in hushed but stern tones, never to reveal what he had been told. Under no circumstances whatsoever. That is, unless Bender had some sadistic wish to incur their immediate and deadly wrath, which he most certainly did not. In fact, so terrified was Bender by the whole experience that on October 1953, he announced to his shocking followers in the pages of Space Review magazine that he was closing the doors on the IFS, on the IFSB, and leaving the flying saucer arena for good. Bender's own words on this matter, published in the final issue of the magazine, only added to the controversy. He said, "We would like to reprint the full story in Space Review, but because of the nature of this information, we are sorry that we have been advised in the negative. We advise those engaged in saucer work to please be very cautious." And that's all Bender said. That was it. That was the end. The legend of the Men in Black and their attendant threats was fully born, and they had successfully claimed their first victim. But these Men in Black, they started to appear all the time. Whenever somebody would have a strange sighting, no matter where they were, it wasn't just in the United States, these strange men would show up and warn you not to talk about it. They'd ask, "Do you have any pictures of it? Let us see them. You better give them to us. You better not tell anybody. We're watching you." People had the feeling that their phones were being tapped. And the men themselves, sometimes women, you know, there were women in black, but mostly men, they don't seem quite right. Like, some of the stories, they sound like they're 100% human, but just a little off. Some of them, they don't look human. There's stories where people say it looks like something trying to copy a human. And what's the most bizarre, not just that that's not bizarre enough, is how do they know you had a sighting? Like, somebody goes out on their back porch, 2:30 in the morning, to have a cigarette. They look up, they see a triangle-shaped UFO. They think it's wild, it's freaky. They don't have a camera. It disappears. They go back in the house. If maybe they're married, they might tell their wife, but that's it. And then suddenly, the next day, these guys show up. Don't tell anybody about what you saw. How did they know the person saw it? There's lots of stories, starting with Bender, and they continue throughout the ages. It's very crazy, but there was a hot spot, too. During the 1980s and 1990s, there occurred a veritable wave of Men in Black activity across both the United States and Great Britain that was directly linked with the so-called alien abduction phenomenon. There were these typical threats, both in person and, like I mentioned, by telephone, sometimes even mail. People noticed that their mail went missing, or there was weird things happening. They were being followed in their car. It was just strange. All the while, the Men in Black looked on with icy approving eyes at the chaos and mental carnage that they were generating. From respected investigator Peter Hoff comes a truly remarkable account with ties to the Men in Black. Of the many and varied cases that Hoff investigated, one concerned a police officer, a guy named Philip Spencer, who in 1987 allegedly stumbled across an apparent alien creature on Ilkley Moor in Yorkshire, England. Now, Hoff's investigation suggested that Spencer had suffered a degree of missing time of the type that is typical of alien abduction incidents. But the most notable aspect of the story was an amazing piece of evidence that Spencer had at his disposal to back up his extraordinary claims. A solitary photograph displaying a small, dark-colored creature striding up a grassy slope on the moors. In an attempt to determine what had occurred during the period of missing time, Spencer was hypnotically regressed. and recalled being taken aboard a large, silver-colored flying saucer, where he underwent some form of physical examination and was given a warning about a future ecological disaster that would affect the planet Earth. More significantly, the regression allowed Spencer to accurately recall in his mind the image of the alien entity that he encountered. It was small in height, somewhere in the region of 4 feet. He said it had pointed ears, large eyes, a small mouth, huge hands, and 3 fingers on each hand that reminded Spencer of large sausages. But that was not all. Guess who was soon to put in an appearance? Yes, you guessed it right. On Friday evening in January 1988, events took even stranger for Spencer, hearing a knock at his front door. Spencer duly opened it, only to find himself confronted by 2 middle-aged men, dressed smartly in business suits. Ominously, both flashed Ministry of Defense identity cards bearing the names Jefferson and Davis. Spencer, puzzled and even somewhat alarmed, duly invited the men in and carefully listened as Jefferson announced that they had come to interview him about his UFO experience on the moors the previous year. Even more odd, Spencer had only discussed his encounter with 3 civilian UFO investigators. Yet, the men from the ministry, or allegedly from the Ministry of Defense, apparently knew all about his experience and fired off a barrage of pointed questions and demands to the perplexed officer in relation to his UFO encounter. See, this is what I'm talking about. How do they know somebody had a sighting? And they know the details. Perhaps mindful of the fact that he was dealing with officialdom, Spencer admitted to having taken 1 photograph, but stated that it was in the possession of a friend and that he didn't have it. In reality, however, the negative was in Peter Hoff's hands at the time in question. With this revelation, the 2 men suddenly lost all interest in further communication and quickly left as mysteriously as they had first arrived. Was this perhaps because they realized they were too late to retrieve Spencer's potentially priceless evidence of his alien abduction? No one really knows. Who were this mysterious pair of men? Were they possibly covert operatives of the British government? Or did they have origins of a much stranger nature? To this day, the true identities of Jefferson and Davis remain mysterious. Moving on almost a decade, we have yet another case from the British Isles. Irene Bott, formerly the president of the Staffordshire UFO Group, investigated a notable case implicating the Men in Black in the alien abduction controversy. Shortly after establishing her group in 1995, Bott was plunged into a situation involving a witness to a UFO, who many very well may have also undergone a period of so-called missing time. Expressing deep desire to learn more about what occurred to him than the fragmentary memories that were circulating around in his brain, the witness contacted Bott and related the details that surrounded his viewing. In the early hours of a 1995 morning of a brightly lit triangular-shaped object in the low skies of the county of Staffordshire, the witness was certain that there was more to the case than he could consciously recollect and expressed a keen desire for help in unraveling what he'd really taken place. As a result, Bott referred the witness to a colleague that was in her group, and the 2 discussed the details over the telephone. Shortly after returning home from work one day, the witness found that there was a note that had been pushed into his letterbox, warning him not to proceed any further with the investigation of his UFO encounter, which means somebody was listening in on the telephone. They had tapped his lines. But who was they? Naturally deeply concerned, the man asked his neighbors if they had seen anyone lurking in the vicinity of his house, who might conceivably have been responsible for the strange and unsettling note. Fortunately, one neighbor had seen something unusual that day. Shortly after the witness had set off for work, a black car pulled up outside of his house. A man dressed entirely in black and carrying an equally black suitcase or briefcase exited the vehicle, marched quickly up the driveway, shoved a piece of paper through the letterbox, hastily returned to the car, and drove off at speed. That's right. One of our mysterious characters, the Men in Black, had struck again. And it was an encounter that justifiably led Irene Bott to ask the still unresolved question. Was this a British man in black? Moving across the Atlantic and back to the United States, a classic MIB case comes from Marie Jones, a prolific author and countless things of both paranormal and mysteriousness, who says, I've always had the biggest interest in unusual phenomenon and alternative things. But with UFOs, I got involved with the Center for UFO Studies in the late 1970s, and I was also in MUFON, a mutual UFO network, for a good 15 years. But it was in the mid-1990s, after I returned to San Diego after living in Los Angeles, that I had some very weird experiences that sounded a lot like something to do with the Men in Black. It all began, says Jones, in 1995, when she placed an advertisement in a free local newspaper asking for people to get in touch with if they were interested in UFOs. It was an action that proved costly with respect to Jones' emotional state of mind. She said, from that ad, a woman contacted me, whom I'd prefer not to name, but whom I'll call Anna. She was like a biker chick. We really hit it off, and we decided to form a group, and it took off really quickly. We were very active and did a lot of investigations, particularly with alien abduction cases and witnesses. As the two got to know one another, Anna confided in Jones that she was experiencing some serious harassment that sounded very much like the classic MIB tactics. Strange people were telephoning their house, and there were knocks at the door from curious-looking characters. Jones added, with regard to this aspect of the story, she said she and her husband lived in a semi-rural area, so they were a bit isolated, which made it more worrying. There were threats on the phone, strange issues with the phone like unusual noises on the line and electronic interference, things like that. And the more we talked, the more I got to know her, the more these things started to happen to my phone. At least partly as a result of her friendship with Anna, it seems, was now herself a target of the Men in Black. Nevertheless, being of a strong and determined character, Jones was not about to let a bunch of skinny, pasty, black-suited souls from who knows where push her around. That's not to say the calls weren't disconcerting, however. It was always a male caller, she said, and the person on the other end had a very robotic voice. They almost sounded like they were talking through some kind of voice changer. It was very stilted, very robotic. This person was telling me what clothes I had on, what book I was reading, what room I was in my house, and the place where I lived. You couldn't see in. That's what made it more bizarre. The calls kept coming, and this person was telling me more and more personal things that they never should have known. Carefully and deliberately, instilling in Joan's mind the notion that her every move was being scrutinized by all-powerful, unseen eyes of a potentially deadly nature can only be interpreted as a classic scare tactic, at which, as we've seen, the Men in Black are amazing at. Jones tried and tried the whole situation, wanted hard answers as to what was afoot and why her and Anna were being targeted. She said, so I asked Anna if she knew anything about these strange and mysterious phone calls. She said that yes, she'd been getting similar calls too, with a really robotic voice. But she also said that some of the people she'd seen them on her property late at night, and her husband would run outside with a gun. These people moved like robots. They were very stiff, very stilted, and stared without blinking their eyes. But they looked human. As the high strangers continued, Jones became even more and more concerned and affected by way in which her previously orderly world was rapidly plunging into chaos, disorder, and terror. She said, I told my husband at the time, don't answer the phone. But looking back, it was crazy that I was even thinking like that. I mean, you have to answer the phone. But it really intimidated me, she said. And some of the calls were late at night when my husband, who was a musician, would be gone rehearsing or even playing.
And this person would always know when I was alone. Always. It was very strange. I could not get rid of this feeling that there was someone and something not right. It wasn't just the way his voice sounded. It was the whole atmosphere. It was horrible. Jones has her own thoughts on the nature of the mysterious man's agenda. Unsurprisingly, she concludes that the tone, nature, and modus operandi of the men in black seem to radiate both hostility and with threats. And many of those threats seem to be directly linked to Jones' studies of alien abduction cases and data. She says, "I believe that what he was trying to do was to let me know that he knew a lot about me and could hurt me if he wanted to. He never actually outright said anything like that or said that he would actually hurt me, but that was definitely the idea he was getting across. It was an insinuation. It was creepy." Looking back on it, the interesting thing is that he was less interested in talking about UFOs as a subject, but more interested in talking about the group and what the group was doing with our abduction research. And this man, instead of asking about UFOs, would say something like, "Your group is familiar with this abductee or that abductee, or with this person or that person." He was letting me know that he knew what the group was doing. I have no idea where he was getting this information from, unless he had my phone tapped. And he was even telling me things about what I'd done back in my 20s, what book I had lying on the bed, and what I was wearing at the time. It just gave me the creeps. It was very creepy. Eventually, the situation began to take its toll on both Anna and Jones to the point that there really seemed to be only one viable option left. Somewhat reluctantly, they elected to close down their research group, and Jones moved back to Los Angeles to live. She says today of Anna and the whole experience with the men in black, "I have no idea what became of her, but I can tell you that I'm not someone that's easy to intimidate. I'm very confrontational. I'll fight. But this person scared me so much that I literally walked away from my own group, and I've never had that happen before. It was a weird kind of foreboding feeling. It made me want to back away and get this person out of my life. I even felt that something not right was going to happen. It was awful." Investigative author Chris O'Brien has a similar account to relate that also focuses on the MIB alien abduction connection. In this particular case, the female witness was referred to him by an unusual source, a sheriff's office in Colorado, O'Brien's state of residency. He takes up the story. "One of the things she mentioned happened right when we were having all sorts of intense waves of UFO activity. In the spring of 1994 and throughout the fall of 95 in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, she kept a very extensive journal, and I cross-referenced some of her claims with our reports, and sure enough, there was a definite correlation. When she would claim to have these UFO experiences, these abductions, we would get UFO sighting reports to us on the exact same nights, but from other people, which I thought was very intriguing and gave some credence to her story in my mind. And then there came a deeply worrying development. The woman's mail failed to arrive on a disturbingly regular basis, and she ended up having to file claims with the post office. Then one particular day, the woman noticed a large black car that looked like it had just been driven out of a 1960s showroom, parked at the end of her driveway. Something sinister was going on. That's what she felt, at least. And given that this involved the men in black, could it really have been anything but sinister? O'Brien says of this development, "It looked like a brand new old car, which is kind of an oxymoron, but that's what she said. And there were these two guys outside the car whom she said looked like the Blues Brothers, going through her mail, getting it out of the mailbox, opening it, and so on. She was watching all this through a spotting scope and was able to catch some details, but as soon as she started heading down there, she got on her ATV and hauled down there, they took off. This happened a number of times before she had to get a post office box in town because she kept missing all of her mail. But she still had problems. And this went on for about a year before it finally finished.
Fortunately, the woman had been able to get a very good look at the strange pair on one occasion when they raided her mailbox. Based on O'Brien's words, they might very well have stepped straight out of the shadowy confines of an old Albert Bender's attic. They had on fedoras, these wraparound shades, and skinny ties. It was the whole Men in Black deal. I tried to get her to come up with some more, another better description, something a bit more credible sounding than like the Blues Brothers, but that's all she would ever say. They looked like Jake and Elwood. Now, we've interviewed Chris O'Brien before. He's been on the show. He wrote a couple books about cattle mutilations there in Colorado. It's a very, very interesting man. I've got one more here for you. Raven Mindell, a cryptozoologist, a writer, a radio host, and a Wiccan priestess, who resides in Michigan, and in 2010 was featured on the History Channel's Monster Quest series, pursuing bloodthirsty werewolves, says that I've been interested in paranormal things and UFOs for years. But when I got involved in doing it more seriously, with research and writing, and in a career-like manner, that's when really strange things started to happen, including a Men in Black experience in April of 2008. Mindell's experience was preceded by a decidedly unusual occurrence in the family home. A week before she had her Men in Black confrontation, her husband, Adam, felt a rush of wind go past him inside of the apartment while the pair were standing there talking. Now, Mindell is sure that there's air conditioning was not on at the time and there were no windows open. It felt, said Adam, like someone had brushed by me, walking briskly past him. Whenever the cause of the odd event, it was an uncanny precursor to the mayhem that was soon to follow. As Mindell makes graphically clear, on April 16th at about 5:30 p.m., two men, dressed all in black, came out of the apartment across from where we were living at the time. The odd thing about this is that no one was living in that apartment back then. They walked away and got into a black Lincoln, and when they walked past, I was outside playing with a Frisbee with a neighborhood kid. The Frisbee was called an alien flyer, which had an alien face on it, which I thought was a very odd synchronicity. Feeling somewhat unsettled by the off-putting presence of the pair, Mindell tried her best to lighten the situation. Her efforts were to no avail, however. Indeed, no one, I'm sure, needs to be told that the Men in Black are hardly known for their fine sense of humor or jollity. We smiled at the guys and we made a joke about something, but they were like totally stone cold, chiseled, hard features, no emotion, nothing. One of them looked like he was in his late 20s or early 30s, and the other was probably in his late 40s or early 50s. They were all in black, and they were both carrying briefcases. At first, says Mindell, she wondered if the two men were Mormons, or perhaps representatives of some other religious group, as there was nothing to indicate that. However, Mindell attempted to move closer to see the license plate of the pair's car as they got inside their black vehicle. Mindell developed a deep suspicion that the pair knew exactly what she was doing, and they backed out real quick and took off. You could tell it was a deliberate maneuver. It was in the immediate wake of this chilling MIB experience that a rain of paranormal terror descended upon Mindell and her family. The telephone would ring, but surprise, surprise, there was no one there. On the night of April 19th, only 3 days after her encounter with the MIB, and while trying to valiantly to fall asleep, which was hardly easy given the nature of the odd activity in the family home, Mindell developed an overwhelming feeling that she could not be undertaking any type of UFO research whatsoever. In her own words, she said, "It was like a terrifying feeling that came on from nowhere. I even felt kind of shaken by it, and I actually said out loud, 'Okay, okay, I won't do it anymore.'" Despite her reluctance to dig further into the complexities of the UFO jigsaw, the Men in Black were far from finished with toying and terrifying her. 2 days later, while Mindell was out walking her dog, something even stranger and scarier happened. A black, luxury-type car, maybe a Cadillac, appeared on the scene and seemed to be shadowing her movements. She says of this, "There was an older man driving and a younger man in the passenger seat. I got a strange sensation. I felt something very strange. They pulled up right next to me. It was like the older man was deliberately stopping to let me know that they were stopping for me, because of me, maybe only a foot from me, right at the edge of the sidewalk. Mindell's fear levels rose dramatically when one of the men took off his seatbelt and appeared to get ready to get out of the car. At that point, Mindell had an idea. She pulled out her cell phone so that the pair would clearly understand she was calling someone and began to walk away from them toward a nearby clubhouse. She said, "I looked over my shoulder," and finally they did leave. But they were very deliberate in their movements. There's no doubt in my mind they were trying to scare me. The scare tactics were working, and they showed no signs of stopping either. A couple of weeks later, Mindell recalls her husband, Adam, distinctly heard on several occasions whispered voices throughout the apartment. Most disturbing of all was the occasion when, to their horror, the family found what appeared to be very strange handprints on the bathroom mirror. One was huge, where the fingers had kind of drawn down the mirror, Mindell says. She had something even more sinister. My daughter, when she came out of the shower that day, had bruises on her arm that looked exactly like the fingerprints that were left on the mirror. Mindell explained that she faithfully recorded all of this undeniably disturbing anomalous activity that plagued the family for months. In the pages of a journal that she had been taking keen foresight and presence of mind to purchase, shortly after 2 a.m. on February 11, 2009, Mindell penned the following passage that clearly illustrates the level of high strangeness that had descended upon her family. She says, "I'm still very shaken from something that just happened. I'm terribly upset and can't get back to sleep. 1:21 was the last time I looked at the clock before having fallen asleep. The next thing I know, I was awake again and was staring at my bedroom curtain. All of a sudden, this harsh, tingling feeling started in my legs and worked its way up my torso and into my head until my whole body was being crushed. Lots of pressure and a loud noise was humming in my ear. I was trying hard to scream, 'Adam,' but I couldn't. I remember looking back toward the curtain and saying to whoever or whatever was there, 'I hate you. Get out of here. I hate you.' Then I came out of it, or I woke up. I lay there wondering if I had the start of a stroke or an aneurysm. I looked at the clock again and it read 1:42 a.m. I'm still woozy and foggy and cannot completely focus my eyes. They feel real dry and irritated. I'm really scared. I don't know if I will sleep anymore tonight. Wow. Did something foul and unspeakable come calling in the early hours of that terrifying morning? And was it linked with the sinister presence of the two men in black? Looking back on what occurred, Mindell believes that is precisely the nature of what occurred. She said, "I have the feeling that when you investigate these things, UFOs, they become aware of it and of you. And why I think that is because when we moved to our new house where we live now, I thought it would be all over. I thought they would leave us alone because we weren't at the old apartment where it all happened. But on day two of being here, Adam and I saw this strange red ball of light come right down over us in the sky. I mean, while we were outside, it felt like someone or something was saying, 'I'm watching you.'" Well, I'll tell you this, folks. I've been investigating UFOs and the paranormal and strange along with Cam for over a decade now. I've never seen any men in black. I hope to never see any men in black, but I do like the stories. Let's take a break. I'm Kyle Filson. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope you like some of those stories. They're pretty creepy. It's very unusual. They've even been talked about, like, they act just odd. The odd behavior is what sets them apart.
Yeah.
You know, that's what everybody encounters. They said that some of them resemble that they're on the spectrum a little bit, like maybe Asperger's syndrome or something. There's something not quite right about these people. Well, whatever this is, it's closely associated to people. They don't really know. Some people describe them as just like government working officials. They seem very normal. But a lot of the sightings saying there's something that just seems off about them. So I don't know. It's a very strange phenomenon. I hope I never meet one, but interesting enough. I mean, I've met our friend Nick Redfern. He said that he had one following him when he was doing some of his earlier books years ago at like an airport. He told the story that it was he was following him around and told him he needed to be careful about what he was researching and stuff like that. Or was it just a person messing with him?
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, too. You get it with the black-eyed kid sightings.
We don't get things like that because they don't think we're any kind of we're no threat.
Well, we're not researchers. That's just relaying stories, right?
That's for sure.
But, you know, the sightings of the black-eyed kids, it's the same kind of thing. Some of them seem demonic. Some of them, it just sounds like kid bought some contacts at, you know, Spirit Halloween and it's just messing with people. I wouldn't suggest doing that. It's a good way to get shot.
Yeah, that's
I guess
it
depends
move.
On where in the world you live when you're playing these pranks. But I would not come to Texas and try that.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
Hey, I've got another story here from you, bro, that took place in 1958. I have to share with you. Because remember, we had talked a little something about this a few shows ago. We had a news story, and this seems to be piling up around there. November 10th, 1958, Riverside, California. A funny thing happened to Charlie Wetzel. I guess he was making pretzels. Wasn't that the pretzel? Wetzel pretzel?
Well, maybe that's Co Wetzel's brother.
Maybe that's Co Wetzel's grandpa. Maybe it's Charlie. A funny thing happened to Charlie Wetzel on the way home Saturday night. A monster jumped out at him. That's what he told authorities who planned to continue an investigation of an incredible story. Wetzel, 24-year-old resident of nearby Bloomington, California, reportedly sober that he was driving on a street near Riverside when a frightening creature jumped out in front of his car. It had a round, scarecrowish head, he said, like something out of Halloween. It wasn't human. It had a longer arm than anything I've ever seen. And when it saw me in the car, it reached all the way back to the windshield and began clawing at me. It didn't have any ears, the face was all round, the eyes were shining like something fluorescent, and it had a protuberant mouth. It was scaly, like leaves. Wetzel said he became terrified when the creature reached over the hood of his car and began clawing at the windshield. He said he then reached for a .22 pistol that he kept in the car. I held the pistol and stomped on the gas, he said. This thing fell back from the car, and it gurgled. The noise it made didn't sound human. I think I hit it. I heard something hit like the pan under the car. Now, the sheriff officers said Wetzel pointed at something, at some thin, sweeping marks, he said, that the creature made on his windshield. They went to the scene of the claimed apparition, but said they could find nothing to prove nor disprove Wetzel's story. The scene at this point, where North Main Street dips across the Santa Ana Riverbed, which is usually almost dry. Wetzel said he told the story to his wife, and she induced him to phone or induced him yet to phone authorities. I kept saying no one would believe a story like this. Sheriff Sergeant E.R. Holmes said he thought perhaps a large vulture might have flopped on the hood of Wetzel's car. Sometimes cars hit them when they're in the road eating rabbits cars have killed. This is what he claims.
Right, yeah.
So he searched the area himself on Sunday, but said Holmes didn't find a feather. So that's all they got. This whole story,
well,
this guy
was
thinks
it,
he's
though, a reptilian?
Well, that's kind of what it sounds like, right? So then I'm going to jump up into pretty recent times in the Yosemite Valley. I want you to listen to this. It says this happened in the Sierra Nevadas in Yosemite Valley, California. It was a place that I'd been looking forward to hiking for a long time. I had prepared all my gear the previous night, double-checking everything, which, good move, water, food, tent, map, all the essentials. I was just itching to get out there and explore. The sun's peeking up over the horizon, and it was just so serene. Anyway, a few hours into the hike, I stopped to refuel, taking a bit of a breather, and I find a nook near a stream. So I'm settling down to eat, and I hear this sound. And first, I think it's probably a squirrel or something. But the sound gets louder, and it gets heavier.
Is it gurgling?
Right, not yet. Suddenly, I'm on alert. I'm no stranger to wildlife, and I instantly knew that this was different. I can just feel it in my gut. So I decide to move towards it and check it out. I tread lightly, trying to figure out the source of the sound, and then I see this creature. It's not a bear. It's not a mountain lion. It's not anything that you would expect to see in the mountains. It was just something different. This creature stood on its hind legs like a human, but was much taller. The body was covered in these scales like a lizard, but these were larger, almost like armor plating. There was also a dark green color, almost black in some places, and its limbs were muscular but lean, like a runner's body, but way more powerful, built like Kyle. The head was the most striking part. It had these slanted, almond-shaped eyes that glowed an eerie yellow. It didn't have a snout, more like a flat face. There were these slits where the nose should be, and a mouth was filled with sharp, jagged teeth, but not like predator's teeth, more like a row of serrated knives, if that makes sense.
Like Land of the Lost.
Like Sleestak's, yes. I didn't see any wings or anything, but it had a long tail, almost as long as its body, like a kangaroo's tail. It had four fingers, but they were long and ended up in these sharp, curved claws. Now, the thing I remember the most was that the creature moved so smoothly, like water flowing over rocks. This thing was almost graceful. Now, you're probably thinking I'm pulling your leg or messing with you, but I swear this is exactly what I saw. This reptilian-like creature was some next-level, out-of-this-world kind of being. I had a good 5 minutes or so to just sit and stare at this thing. It's standing there at the edge of the clearing just observing me, like it's trying to figure me out. It didn't seem hostile. I mean, now it was freaky as hell, and I didn't want to provoke it, but instead of it coming at me, it just kind of mirrored me as I moved. It was like we were doing some kind of dance. Now, I know it sounds nuts, but it was as if this creature was just as curious about me as I was about it. We stood there for what felt like hours, but I'm sure it was just a few minutes. And at one point, I could swear it made a sound like a low hum or something. I couldn't make much of it, but it didn't seem threatening. Then suddenly it turned and disappeared. I was in shock. I mean, what did I just witness? So now at this point, there I was alone in the clearing with my heart pounding like a drum. I'm just standing there wondering if this really just happened. I was just trying to process everything, and I decided to follow the direction this creature went. I couldn't just let it go. I had to know more. So, as I moved to where the creature disappeared, I noticed these huge tracks on the ground. It was not anything I'd ever seen in my guidebook or anything, and the air felt different too, almost electric. It felt charged, and there was this energy around that I can't explain. So I pushed through the undergrowth following the tracks. It felt like I was in some kind of dream or movie, like at any moment I would just wake up back in my tent and it would all be over. But no, this was real, and this was actually happening. I walked further into the woods. I noticed that the tracks became harder to find. Then, they started to disappear. It was like this creature had just vanished into thin air. I must have looked around for an hour or more, but there was no other sign of it. It was gone. But I swear to you that every time I've closed my eyes that night, I could see those eyes. Its form was burned into my memory. I still cannot believe what I saw that day. Thanks, KL.
Wow. So see, we know
two in California, two of those now.
So what is this? Is this extraterrestrial? Is it something that crawled out of a cavern? You know, what is it? Because we know that there's no upright walking lizards roaming around the planet, anywhere on the planet. I mean, it's just not a real thing. But what is it? Is it something from another dimension? Did it bleed through? Or is it something demonic? It knows that he watched Land of the Lost when he was a little kid, and it's manifesting its form into something that it knows would scare him. What is it?
Yeah.
Why is he seeing? Isn't it just a hallucination? And if it is a hallucination, what are the chances of different people from different parts of the same state seeing the same manifestation?
Yeah.
Right. Or other places.
And I find it really interesting is where it was, Yosemite Valley, this whole thing. Like there is enough place that things could hide. And maybe it is. Maybe there's portals there. Maybe what they were feeling or smelling or whatever this charge was when they talk about the ozone changing, all of this stuff changing whenever there's a portal or something that could be around.
I'd like to believe that there was a recent earthquake, and when that happened, it formed a crack opened in the crust of the earth, and these lizard-like things are coming out of the inner earth.
I'm down with you. I'm down for that. Sign me up. That sounds awesome.
Make a good movie.
Yeah.
Are you getting ready to go? Are you going to take your granddaughter trick-or-treating or what do they call it when they do it just in a parking lot?
Trunk or treat.
Yeah. You doing any trunk or treating?
I've not been informed if that's what I'm doing yet, because I'm not sure exactly what she's going to go as. They've not informed me of this as of yet, but I hope not. Look, They don't need me there. I don't need to carry anything. You're driving up, they're giving you candy, you're driving off. Like if you were walking the streets, you might want some protection or somebody to go with you, but look, you're riding around and all of our family goes together. So it's all the nieces and nephews and then all of their kids and all of this. So there's going to be like 20 of them in a group when they go out. Right. So I'm like, dude, keep a few of them. Don't send, I'll trade them off. Right? There's so many, but yeah, no, I don't think so. What about you? Y'all, your boys though, Luke just likes to get dressed up and go
for
the heck of it. He don't really care about the candy.
Yeah,
so much.
Not really. No, we're going to take him to a couple haunted houses this next week.
I bet he is pumped for that.
He is. Him and my wife just went and watched the new Exorcist movie.
Oh, did he love it?
Oh, yeah, he loved it. I mean, I don't know what it was. And then the week before, he saw the newest Saw movie. I didn't know. I mean, I guess they just keep
like
pumping
Vincent
him out.
Price.
He is. He is.
That is. He's the new Vincent Price. Little Fizzy. Well, Little Fizzy knows no fear.
Well, before we get out of here, let's thank our sponsors. Join Fume and accelerating humanity's breakup from destructive habits by picking up your journey pack today. Head to tryfume.com. That's TRYFUM.com and use the code expanded to save 10% off when you get your order today. Also, AG1. If you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs. With your first purchase, go to drinkag1.com/expanded. That's drinkag1.com/expanded. And if you have any stories you'd like to share with me and Cam and the listeners, email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 888-393-2783. That's 888-393-BROOD. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Well, I got a message from a young lady. Miss Tasha sent me a cool thing online. I'm going to be looking into, we're going to have to bring it up on the next show, of people finding human teeth randomly in their house.
What?
Yeah. Just like, oh, there's a human tooth under your bed, or, oh, wow, there's a human tooth in the middle of your floor, or just crazy things of people finding human teeth.
I've randomly. Never heard of this.
Yeah, me neither. And I don't know what's going on, but how disturbing would that be?
Yeah, very.
I mean, you're finding nobody in your family. These are like adult molars that are just there in the floor. You don't just lose those. You're not a shark, right? They don't just fall out.
The tooth fairy.
The tooth fairy.
Leaving them, taking them
Maybe
from some places
so.
And delivering them otherwhere.
So I'm really curious. I've got to look into that. This is an unsettling thing I'm going to be looking into. But other than that, I'm working on doing a little video editing and hopefully get back in the trees again, as long as the weather's good.
I got you. I'm not going to be doing much either. It's going to be a pretty low-key week for me.
Nice.
That's about all the time we have for this episode, folks. Till next time, be safe. I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.